Okay, thanks, Anna, and I'd like to thank the organisers for inviting me to speak here. I was a bit reluctant at first because I haven't actually been doing it. This is my first knot theory conference since Vietnam, and haven't really been doing anything directly in knots, but I guess I've never been all that far from it, so I'll you get a favour anyway from the knot theory. So I'm sure everyone's tired after the trip here. I certainly am. Trips tend to be pretty hectic, so I thought I'd start off with what's supposed to be relaxing, a bit of history. I want to give a bit of history of phonemic algebras, so you're not supposed to necessarily understand it all, but just sort of take it in as history. And it's also meant to motivate the why I'm so puzzled and elated in some sense by this what I'm calling duality. So the title, but it's a curious duality in planar algebra. So there's really supposed to be two algebras here. All right, so let's just relax, and I want to tell you a little bit about the beginning of phonemic algebras. So they were developed in the 1930s by Murray and von Neumann. And what they're all about is decomposing unitary group representations. Unitary group representation, you have to have a Hilbert space to talk about unitarity, and then you have to have a group to talk about groups, and then a representation is a homomorphism from the group to the unitary, so that to say that it's unitary means that it's adjoint in the Hilbert space sense, the conjugate transpose, is actually the inverse. I think everyone knows or should know that if you want to, you got that on camera, didn't you? If you want to decompose a representation,
you shouldn't
breathe. If it keeps on going, I'll turn it off and try to talk about it.
That's the back beat. You're supposed to wrap the talk.
So, life's a bit of you. Carry this around. So, if you've ever done any representation theory at all, which of course you should have done, you know that what you look at, if you try to decompose such a representation into smaller pieces, is look at the commutant. So you look at the set of all x from h to h, such that so you can look at all the set of operators that commute with the group representation, and I'm going to give this a notation that I'll probably use from time to time. That's called the commutant. And so, of course, if you have elements in the commutant, then any subspace of the Hilbert space which is connected to them will be invariant under the group. So, for instance, if you have a projection P in the commutant, then the subspace onto which it projects, PH, will obviously be invariant under the group. So every time you have a projection in the commutant, you have an invariant subspace, and so you can decompose the group representation into smaller pieces using orthogonal projection. It's also true, of course, that the orthogonal complement of the subspaces invariantly get a nice direct sum Hilbert space decomposition of the group representation. Now this actually, if you want to know what the term phonomial algebra means, this actually serves as a definition. Phonomial algebra is, by definition, the commutant of some unitary group representation. Definition. Phonomial algebra. So if you didn't know what they were before, you know now. Alright. For finite groups, this process works perfectly. You can look at projections in the commutant, you can sort of start to look for smallest ones and you get irreducible representations, and the group representation decomposes in a canonical way it's not quite canonical for irreducible, but it decomposes as a direct sum of irreducible representations. This works reasonably well also for infinite groups at the beginning, but even for abelian groups you have to introduce something a bit more general than the direct sum. You have to take what's called a direct integral of representations, and that works fine for compact groups and semi-simple Lie groups. But what Murray and von Neumann discovered was that this process, this way of reducing representations into reducibles, starts to go wrong, and it just sort of doesn't work at all as soon as you start looking at a certain kind of group. And here's the kind of group that they were started looking at. It's the so-called the discrete group, so they'll be very familiar groups to everyone here. So I'm going to use the term ICC group. This means infinite conjugacy classes. So groups such that every non-identity element has an infinite conjugacy class. You won't have any trouble thinking of such groups. Most groups are like that up to maybe a little bit of center or something. But I want to emphasize two examples. S infinity, which is a group of permutations of a countably infinite set, and free groups on n generators for n greater than 2. There's lots of other examples. For instance, the Braid group actually is almost there. It has the center. But if you're quotient by the center, then the Braid groups are also infinite conjugacy classes. And the infinite Braid group, infinite linear strings, is infinite ICC straight away. But I just want to make sure the ones that we can talk about in this history are these two.
And any not group.
Any not group.
Not conference, any not group. Except for the torus knots.
Torus knots. Good. Thank you. So now what happens is that any group, discrete group, let's call it gamma, has a very special, highly not trivial, unitary representation, which is the regular representation. You can act both on the left and on the right of L2 functions. It's a nice Hilbert space. So another way of thinking, of course, is you just commute a basis. You have an orthonormal basis of your Hilbert space indexed by the group, and you just shift them around according to the group action. And what Murray and von Neumann noticed was that there's two things about this. Let's look at its commutant. So let's take the 7-OU gamma commutant. So if we wanted to decompose it into irreducibles, then that's what you would look at. And then notice that there's two things on this commutant that are very nice, both very nice, but totally incompatible with a nice decomposition into irreducibles, even by a direct integral. And these are that it is what's called a factor. That means that center is trivial. So there's nothing that commutes with everything in the commutant except the scale. This is in finite groups, for instance, is what's called isotypical, which means that you only see one kind of irreducible representation. So that is true. And then the second thing is that there's a trace. So there's a linear function which goes from this commutator to the scalars and satisfies trace of AB is equals trace of BA, and it's sort of, it's very non-trivial. In fact, this trace is very easy to see. You just, if you're working in L2, you just take the characteristic function of the identity, and then you take x times that, you take the obvious in the product like that. That turns out to be a trace, quite easy to see. And anyway, so these two are totally incompatible. This sort of means that there's no nice decomposition, no canonical even decomposition into the group. Into irreducibles or isotypicals, it just doesn't work. Everything goes wrong. So, you know, this is too bad for representation theory, because such a group is, after all, not that far from home, right? I mean, even if you're studying semisimple Lie groups, you'll run into these groups all the time as discrete as lattices inside these semisimple groups. So, what Murray and von Neumann undertook was a study of these von Neumann algebras with these two properties, and other ones, but in some sense they focused on these, and they called these, this is a term that you probably heard and never know what it was, a type 2-1 factor. So the 2-1 means that this type 1, which is the familiar stuff, then this type 2-1, which is this next most familiar, and then there's some other types, type 3, eventually, if you want to. So, a lot of the work in this series of, this monumental series of four papers of Murray and von Neumann in the 30s and perhaps even early 40s was devoted to the study of these 2-1 factors. And what I want to say is that they came up with all kinds of properties, obviously, of these things, and they're going to be very relevant to what I have to say. So, the first big theorem in this direction was with this, what they call hyperfinite. So, a 2-1 factor will be called hyperfinite if it's sort of approximately finite dimensional. So if there's some union of ans, some increasing union of ans, such that these are finite dimensional, okay, it's important that this be an increasing union, and this is dense. You wouldn't expect just the union of the finite dimensional things to be a whole commutant, because the whole commutants are closed in various convergences, in various topologies, so to say that it's dense is the best you can hunt for. And what they proved was actually an amazing uniqueness result, is that there's only one such 2-1 factor. So that's sort of amazing, because you know, you could imagine all kinds of ways of taking these unions of finite dimensional algebras and getting a factor, but at the end of the day you get the same one all the time. So that has some interesting, you know, let me see. I can do some this. Press. Sorry, I wasn't concentrating when I got my tutorial. Thank you. Fantastic. We'll do it. So we have one of these, an example of this finite 2-1 factor at hand, because you remember I said that this was an ICC group. So if I take the commutant of S infinity in the regular representation, so this construction over here, I let it act on its L2 space, and then I'll take the commutant. This is obviously hyperfinite. A And that's simply because there's an increasing sequence of finite groups, which exhausts the whole algebra. So, I guess it's not quite as clear as I would like it to be. I just have to make one remark that there's a complete symmetry between left and right in this L2 of gamma, and the commutant is sort of the same up to the symmetry as the algebra generated by the group itself. Okay, you just flip between them. So this commutant really—it's sort of like a completion of the group algebra. If you like, if you have the right regular representation in the commutant and generated, so this really just looks like the group algebra of S infinity closed. And there's this obvious sequence of finite groups which exhaust it. All right, now they constructed this hub-finite 2-1 factor in a different way, which there's lots of ways to say this, but one way is to say that instead of taking ordinary representations, you take projective representations. But let me write that up something that might be familiar. If you take two unitaries U and V, such that they satisfy these commutation relations, U, V, theta, V, U, and theta is irrational with respect to pi, then this generates a 2-1 factor. You have to do it properly. You have to do it, you take it on L2 of Z plus Z, which you think of as being, the underlying, you think of this as giving you a projective representation of Z plus Z, given by the copy of U and the copy of V, that act in the right way, and you play the same game as here, and you find you get a 2-1 factor. Now this 2-1 factor is generated by this U and V, and these U and Vs are just unitaries, not periodic or anything. So I just want to emphasize that there's no finite dimensional algebra inside. Okay. If you just try to write down some matrix units or something using this U and V, you will have a tough time. Nevertheless, and this was one of the beginnings of ergodic theory. Marion Fondlon managed to show that you can actually produce matrix algebras in this thing, and enough to make it hyperfinite in this sense. Okay, are there any questions at this stage? This is already sort of quite a powerful result, but the technical ingredient that's really important here is what's called Rockland's, the very elementary theorem of ergodic theory called Rockland's lemma. Okay. So I have to wet this thing. Maybe the bone's already wet. Oh, I don't have to do that yet because I should turn this one. Alright, now, on the other hand, so in the last of this series of these very familiar papers, they looked at the free groups, Fn, the n greater than 2, and they showed that the Fn commutant was, the Fondlon algebra corresponding to the free groups on n generators. It's a type 2-1 factor because the group has infinite conjugacy classes, but they showed that it's not hyperfinite. Okay, so what's interesting about this example is that there's no finite dimensional subalgebras inside, right? You've got this free group, trying to write down anything finite dimensional, you just can't get it. On the other hand, that was true in this example as well. Had these two copies of Z, there was no torsion, nothing even remotely finite dimensional. This one was hyperfinite. So this was a bit of a tour de force, and but it's, with hindsight, it's relatively easy to see what the technique was, and I think I can even communicate it reasonably well, leaving out the main technical detail. But the tool that was used to prove that this is not hyperfinite, therefore there's more than one of these 2-1 factors, was what's called central sequences. And And you can see that if we take this S infinity example, you can see central sequences. So an element is the center of an algebra, an element that commutes with everything. A central sequence of an algebra is a sequence of elements that tend to commute better and better with everything. Okay? So for instance, if we take S infinity, we can take the transpositions, take the transpositions between two neighboring points. We arrange the points in a straight line like that, and then we take this transposition, that one, and so on. You'll all agree that in the group, and therefore it's group algebra, if you take a fixed element, it's a permutation that only permutes finite things, so eventually your transposition out here is going to commute with it. Right? Well, that goes through to the closure as well, obviously, that this sequence has the property, this sequence of transpositions has the property that given any element of the group algebra, the limit of the commutator of these transpositions with it will tend to zero. Okay, so the limit, for any x, we have the limit of x in n plus 1, the commutator tends to zero. And then in sort of in the relevant topology. So, and so what they, what the real meat of what Marion von Neumann proved was that in the, for the free group of two generators, this has these generators UA and UB, and they showed that if you commute well enough with UA and UB, then you're actually, there's 13 epsilon, and you're actually very close to the identity. Right? So it's a very, it's highly non-commutative. You can't even approximately commute with everything without being close to the identity. These things, these transpositions, of course, there's no way they converge to the identity. They're doing stuff all the way out. Okay, so that's, I think that's in a nutshell all I wanted to say about von Neumann algebras. Maybe that's the culprit. Let me ask if there's any questions at this stage. So everyone hopefully enjoyed that little bit of history. This story was all over by the early 1940s. I should perhaps say how things evolved from there, perhaps, between 1940s and now. So in Marion von Neumann's day, by the end of their series of magnificent series of papers, they had two of these two unfactors, basically coming from two different kinds of groups. Then people started to discover more. Then there was three, and then there was four, and five, and six, and seven, I think, got up to nine. Ones basically by playing with these central sequences and how they commute among themselves. There may be about nine mutually non-isomorphic two unfactors. And then someone whose name is probably known to most of you, but will surprise you in this context, Duse McDuff. And the thesis actually discovered an infinite family of mutually non-isomorphic two unfactors, all coming from groups with various properties. And at the same time, there was someone from, someone called Sakai, who discovered this same thing. So by filling with groups and doing all kinds of complicated group constructions and playing with these simple sequences, you could construct an infinite, indeed uncountable, family of mutually non-isomorphic type 2 unfactors. So this sort of dashed the hopes of, when the hyperfinite one was discovered, obviously the hope was that that's it, and with our representation theory of discrete groups, we don't have to work any harder than the structure. But then there was all this infinite family that was discovered, and then nowadays, Alan Kahn produced invariants of two nice, invariants that you can write down to produce huge families. And now in the last 10 years, Soren Popper has this sort of factory, so he can produce designer two unfactors. You give him the property, he'll produce you the two unfactor with that property. So things are very bleak in terms of the understanding of the representation theory of discrete groups, which I guess is as it should be. All right, so now I'd like to change gears and talk about something, which is which is more in line with this conference, and that's tangles. So you all know John Conway invented this notion of a tangle when he was quite young. He decided that, I haven't been doing much not theory. I completely lost my form in drawing pictures of these things. So. That'll have to do. So Conway's concept of a tangle was, at least in the sort of two-dimensional projection version, you have a disk, and then you have some boundary points on that disk, and inside the disk you have strings, which are actually in three dimensions, connecting the boundary points. Right? So with this, the idea was that given some kind of picture of a knot, you could split it up into these various tangles which are connected in different ways. So, inspired, as we might see eventually, by this phenomenological stuff, I came to the idea of somehow splitting up this calculus of tangles into a sort of knot part and a non-knot part. So the idea is to think of a tangle as being, in a non-unique way, a bunch of Conway tangles of crossings, so one of these and each one of these, with a sort of external connection system, which is which is planar. Okay, so no crossings. So that's the idea. So basically, out of this structure, you just forget the crossings and you lump them all together into these internal disks, which you then sort of put in some abstract structure, and you think of the Conway tangles as being a space acted on by these planar pictures here, these planar pictures, which I call planar tangles. So a planar tangle will be just one of these guys. So a planar tangle is something into which you could, if you wanted, stick Conway tangles and come out with another Conway tangle. So this makes Conway tangles, therefore, an algebra. And that's, what sort of structure does this collection of planar tangles have? Well, the nearest mathematical thing you'll find is that of an operad. Because you can, if you have these internal disks and then you have other planar tangles, and if the number of boundary points lines up, you can sort of glue another planar tangle inside there and you get another planar tangle. They're introducing crossings. So then it looks also like an operad. She has a lot in common with it, and there's no sort of algebra over an operad, which is exactly the right notion. So we define planar algebra to be an algebra over the operad of planar tangles. Well, now I think I'm stuck with it. Got to do this. Now let's see, if I erase the back side as well, and by the time I finish that, this front side should be dry. And now I'm going to avoid that if possible. So there we go. So there we have it. That's the definition of a planar algebra. Is an algebra And an example, of course, in fact, that's sort of where we got the notion from, is Conway tangles. But what I'm forced to consider was the possibility of other algebras over this planar operator, where what you put in the disks, what you put in these disks may have little or indeed nothing to do with knots. Okay? So we're just taking the structure from tangle theory, the sort of planar part of it, we're forgetting about the crossings, and we're putting in these things, objects that have a priori nothing whatsoever to do with knots. So a simple example where you see it is tensors. If you can think of a tensor as having some indices, right? Here's a tensor R, and you can think of it as a beast like that, where if you put the indices on the boundary, then that gives you a number. That's what a tensor is. If you take some indices, it'll give you a number. And if you have a planar tangle like this one over here, and you put in a couple of tensors there, R and S, then the output of this tangle applied to these tensors in this way is the following. You have to give some I1, I2 all around the boundary, I3, I4, I4, I5, I6. Now what you simply do is some of these internal boundary points are going to be connected to each other, so you simply sum over these. So it's just like the Einstein summation convention, except it's even more economical. You don't even put indices there. You just no indices at all. But what the moral content of it is you sum over you contract over the indices that are connected, internally connected. Okay, so that pretty obviously makes planar algebra out of tensors. Okay, and a priori, these tensors have nothing whatsoever to do with knots. Okay, so that was the idea, and I'll try to say how that came about as I go on. But if you're puzzled, so that's one example. Let me give you another example which looks closer to knots. But we'll still have the disadvantages that you can't replace things by knots, and that's going to be what's called the Fuss-Catalan number, Fuss-Catalan algebra, which was discovered by Dietmar Bresch myself. So a Fuss-Catalan tangle is one in which you have no crossings, but the boundary is split up into two different colours, which are, for reasons best known to me, I'm making occur two at a time or so. And the Fuss-Catalan tangle is one in which it's like a what we call typically Liebel-Kaufmann tangle with no crossings, but the points, the rule is that the two colours are connected amongst each other. Okay? So that's all there is to it. No crossings, but it has this planar structure. Well, you can put one of these things in a planar tangle. If I had a planar tangle, get one down there very quickly. Seem to be always drawing the same one. What you can do is you can double the strings. You can double the strings. So I just put next to this one in this pattern a. Hope you get the pattern right here. It's a second string. And then you simply, when you put this one, you do the obvious thing, right? You just slot this one in here. And you get out another tangle in the same, which satisfies all the same properties. So this is called the Fuss-Catalan algebra. And try as you might to introduce some knot theory into it, you just can't. It seems to have nothing to do with knot theory. Though it is possible to define statistical mechanical models and other ingredients that we know and love for this fuscatolin stuff is done by De Francesco. Right. Now, what was Conway's great idea with these tangles was skein theory, right? So we want to now take up skein theory. So the idea of skein theory, of course, he introduced to originally to calculate the Alexander polynomial, and the idea was that you, by having some relation like this minus this, right, or something or other times this, some orientations, and you could apply this relation a whole bunch of times in isotropy knots to reduce the Alexander polynomial, to reduce tangles, the space of linear combinations of tangles with zero boundary points to a one-dimensional space, and thereby calculate the Alexander polynomial. Now, of course, we know well that Lou Kaufman came up with a sort of super skein theory where you can just replace this immediately by this linear combination of this and this, and that plus isotopy or regular isotopy or something allows you to calculate an invariant of, once again, of closed tangles with no boundary points, and therefore an invariant of knots. So one of the things that I tried to do with a certain amount of success, probably I've had some great success in recent years thanks to the work of some of my students and co-workers, is to adapt the idea of skein theory to this situation where you have things that are not particularly knots. So I imagine an arbitrary planar algebra, and I look for elements that I can put in, so which I could label R with a certain number of boundary points, and then I imagine a tangle with all of these R's all over the place, right? And plane of thing, another R here, and connect it up. And I tried to find sort of generalized skein relations, which are sort of linear combinations of such pictures. I put them equal to zero, and I try to show that those relations, which may look nothing like randomized Toulouse or these Conway and Kaufman relations, but I want them to have the property that they collapse the space of all tangles to something finite dimensional. Okay, I'm always linearizing. They collapse the space of all tangles to something finite dimensional, and the space of tangles with no boundary points to something one-dimensional. So I have what would be an invariant of knots, but it just becomes an invariant of labeled planar tangles, where I put these labels on everything. So we've found lots and lots of such skein relations. The simplest is this one, is one that's obeyed by this Fuss-Catalan thing. If you can write a generator here, you can actually make all these pictures. You can make them all from one tangle with four boundary points, this one here. You can always arrange one of these Fuss-Catalan diagrams so it looks like this stuff with planar stuff around it. And so if we simplify this picture to be that picture there, so remember the string is double, double, then that satisfies this so-called exchange relation, which is this equals some linear combination of this plus this. So this is unfamiliar territory for knot theory. It's not the randomized Toulouse, it's not the Conway or Kaufman skein theory, but in fact it's easy to prove that this relation is sufficient to reduce everything to finite dimensionality. You just draw an arbitrary tangle with these crossings, not over or under or anything, but And you go in here and you look for an n-gon inside here, and then it turns out that if you apply this relation, the appropriate point on the n-gon, you collapse that n-gon to an n-1 gon. You keep on going, and you've got your collapse to finite dimensions. So that's an example. I guess I'm running out of time, which is sad, because I really haven't got to these we want to get. So one quick word, gloss over a whole subject, is the structure of planar algebra was sort of in the air. It wasn't, you know, I have my approach, which was dictated by these two other factors and so on. Greg Cooperberg had another approach which produced a very similar thing, where he didn't sort of manifestly use the planar structure. He deduced that it satisfied these planar symmetries. And then there's the people in category theory who have these tensor categories and two categories and so on. But I want to make my approach sort of distinguish it as much as possible from the category theory approach, because of that approach makes privilege certain tangles. So, you know, the category has these morphisms and so on, and they're given by certain tangles, so that right at the beginning, certain special tangles are privileged. Whereas I want to sort of be completely unprejudiced and say, planar algebra, we have all of these operations, and we should look at all of them somehow. Okay? Now, on the other hand, the most advanced part of the structure of this is, of course, coming from the tensor categories in algebra, so I just need this terminology, finite depth. And I say that planar algebra is finite depth if the tensor category, the corresponding tensor category, is semi-simple and has finitely many irreducible objects. Classes of irreducible objects. Okay, so there's a whole lot of stuff there that I didn't define well. There's some finiteness property called finite depth. It's not, it's by the way, not satisfied in that Fuss-Catalan example, it's not finite depth. Never. So, to get on, I want to actually give you two algebra structures and ways of coming up with type 2-1 factors from these gadgets here. First should be very familiar. It's sort of has a very grade group-like feel to it. And it's somehow been in this area, this TQFT area, since the beginning. And that's the following. So the idea of this, there's lots of a planar algebra has lots and lots of associative algebras, and even Lie algebras, they're defined. So that's what I mean by planar algebra. It's the study of all of the algebras that you can get from a planar algebra. And here's one of them. So if we have a planar algebra, I'm going to denote Pn. Pn is a planar algebra. That means for every n, there's a vector space. And n is the sort of number of boundary points that these elements go into. So remember, elements of a planar algebra, you stick them in the internal disks to get something corresponding to the external disk, just like tangles. So Pn, this is the vector space going into disks with two n bounding points. Well, this has an obvious algebra structure, which is this one. AB is that tangle, this planar tangle, A applied to AB, A and B. So that gives you a, and this gives you also an obvious inclusion of algebras. You can put Pn inside, this compared to Pn into Pn plus 1. There's an obvious trace on such an algebra, which is this. This is the trace of A. And this makes all of any planar algebra, makes it into an infinite-dimensional inductive limit algebra, infinite-inductive limit, and if all of these are finite-dimensional, which we would certainly like, that's the philosophy of Conway from Conway on, these are all finite-dimensional, then if you can make this into a finite algebra, it's obviously going to be hyperfinite. So it turns out that you do get, and yeah, you can get examples perfectly easily from Conway's game theory. If you take this Kaufman bracket and you put the parameter equal to a appropriate root of unity, then you will get all of the structure going on and you will get a hyperfinite 2-1 factor coming out of it. Now, more recently, I've been involved in a project which has studies a different algebra structure on PNs, and it's a graded algebra this time. So this is the second planar algebra algebra. And instead of using this tangle, it's a very familiar tangle, for instance for braids, I'm going to use this tangle. So this is AB. So this obviously goes from PN plus PN to PN plus N. And so we get an algebra which in this instance has sort of no obvious finite dimensional subalgebras, right? You take something in here, you multiply it, then you get something higher in the grading, so there's no hope of exhibiting easily finite dimensional subalgebras. So if you were able to get a phenomenal algebra out of it, then you would not expect it perhaps to be hyperfinite, except don't forget there was that example of the projective representation of Z plus Z, where there was nothing obviously finite dimensional, but it was hyperfinite anyway. Well, in order to make it a 2-1 factor, you have to have a trace. And this was the ingredient that eluded me for a long, long time until I had this collaboration with Alice Guionet and Dimash Sliatenko, in which we realized that the trace, there is a nice trace on this, and it comes from Voiculescu's consideration of random matrices. So, I'm unfortunately running out of time, so I won't have much time to say how this trace arose, but here it is anyway. This is a funny one. Like I said, there's no, you wouldn't think of this immediately, which is why it took so long. You could define the trace. Of x. So x is going to be in one of these particular spaces, in one of the particular graded spaces. You define its trace to be the following thing. You put x in there, it has a whole lot of boundary, it goes into some space with a whole lot of boundary points, and then you contract that with another very special element, and this element is what we call sigma tl. So you take the sum of all the Kaufman diagrams that connect this. So, you know, the Kaufman or Temporally Lead diagrams are all are these pictures with no crossings, and you take the sum of them all. That's the sort of the funny thing to do. Take the sum of them all. And that turns out to be a trace. And it has all the ingredients to give you a type 2-1 factor. So this, in other words, this graded algebra, when you consider this trace and do the right things to it, you get a type 2-1 factor. So here we have two ways to produce type 2-1 factors from planar algebra. One is this very standard Markov trace inductive limit way. And this other way is this graded algebra Voiculescu trace, we call this the Voiculescu trace. Because it turns out that this summing over all the Temporally Lead things has to do with the large n limit of random matrices. So the idea is that we have on one hand this hyperfinite thing, which is large, which is infinite matrices, and right. And we have this one over here, which Voigt-Gillescu showed to be large, infinite random matrices, handled right. Okay. So anyway, to cut the story a bit shorter, we can show that the 2-1 factor you get from here is actually L of Fn. It's one of these free group ones, where there's an interesting game that this n ends up not being an integer. There's a sort of way to make free groups on a real number of generators in this theory, and the n is actually something like 1 plus delta minus 1 times I. Oh, sorry, this, we only have this result when it's finite depth.
So, I lost you. What is the planar algebra now?
Any one with the suitable positivity conditions. So, for instance, tangles at the appropriate, with the Kaufman skein module at the appropriate root of unity. You give me a planar algebra, if it has, the main thing is positivity of the integral. If it has that property, I can construct this. Yeah. Examples, not theory tenses. I can also do that construction. That one's always hyperfinite. This one is in this free world. This, by the way, is the global index, which has something to do with the TQFT associated with it. Now, I'm sorry that I haven't got to my duality. I'm out of time, but I'm going to take 2 more minutes, okay? So I'll put it in, get it in late. So what have we got? We've got the hyperfinite situation here. And we've got the free situation here. These were the things that Marion von Neumann saw as diametrically opposite. One's hyperfinite, the other one is totally not hyperfinite. Okay? We got them from the same thing, from the planar algebra. And what I claim is that there's some kind of 90-degree rotation which allows you to pass from this hyperfinite world to this free world, which is non-approximately finite dimensional world. And that comes when you consider the subfactor that's associated with the thing. We start to see this duality. And so here it is. There's a subfactor in both pictures. And, you know, this subfactor is of interest. It was the motivating thing all along, and it's some kind of really tight bundling of the structure of the planar algebra. So if you wanted in this inductive limit picture, the planar algebra is simply... When we embedded the things, we put this line to the right. Now, if we put a line to the left, look at the set of all such elements, x, with a line going straight down here. You think braids, if you like, braids in which the first string goes straight down. And this gives you a subfactor, which then the information in the subfactor actually is sufficient for you to reproduce the whole planar algebra of tensor category when you want to call it. So it's a very tight sort of way of putting all this information together into an algebra and so on. If you rotate this picture by 90 degrees, you get this. Then you just fiddle a bit and get this. Okay? And that, this is actually wrong, but you'll have to do it, actually gives you the subfactor in this free world over here. And so that's the duality. By rotating the picture by 90 degrees, you get the object over here. You go from one world to another. Now, it's not obviously not an algebra homomorphism, it's just a pictorial phenomenon. Works. The one thing that really doesn't go, of course, is the trace, which is why the whole thing took so long. If you take the rotated Markov trace, you do not get the trace, the Voigt-Gillescu trace at all. So there's some mystery in this duality, but the duality goes as far as the so-called quantum double. This is the Brunfeld center, the quantum double, and subfactor worlds called the asymptotic conclusion, discovered by Oppenheimer. And anyway, there's a pictorial version of that. You rotate the pictures by 90 degrees, and you get the pictorial version of the quantum double over here. This is in recent work of Stephen Curran, Jack Tenko, and myself. And over in this free world, we can also make the TQFC come out somehow. So we have some definite relationship between the TQFT and large random matrices, which looks like it's very worth exploring, but I'm over having already gone over more time than I should have, so I'll stop there. Thank you.
Has any quick questions? So if not, let us sample in 10 minutes.